generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with our voices on VOA.
Today is Wednesday, July 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as U.S. coronavirus cases surge and the death toll rises, is the Trump administration looking to sow doubt about what top health officials are saying?
For the most part, you can trust respected medical authorities. You know, I believe I'm one of them, so I think you can trust me.
An emotion-filled day for one of France's biggest annual celebrations.
Very small moment on a very important day, and to have the president and the whole government standing there clapping you, thanking you for what you did to help the country through. It was very emotional.
Also ahead, the 27-year-old grandson of the king of rock and roll, the late Elvis Presley, has died. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States continues to struggle with containing the coronavirus pandemic as cases rise in at least 41 states. Public health officials have been warning for months that the U.S. needs to open gradually, social distance, and about the dangers of asymptomatic people infecting those who are at high risk of more serious complications of COVID-19. This as President Trump has sought to continually downplay the pandemic and paint a more upbeat, but often with misleading information. In a virtual conference hosted by Georgetown University, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top U.S. infectious disease physician, said Americans can trust respected medical authorities. Fauci has been contradicting the president in recent days, including Trump's push to reopen schools.
As a principle, we should try as the default to get the kids to stay in school. However, that's going to vary from where you are in the country and what the dynamics of the outbreak are in your particular region.
This week, we heard there was something akin to opposition research in politics coming from the White House to try to discredit Fauci. There has been strong pushback from medical professionals and former heads of the Centers for Disease Control on this, calling President Trump's efforts deceptive and dangerous. President Trump at a news conference on Wednesday.
People are feeling good about our country. People are feeling good about therapeutics and possible vaccines.
Joining us to talk more about what's happening in the United States is Jennifer Victor, Associate Professor of Political Science at the Scharf School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in the state of Virginia. Thanks so much for being with us. So how dangerous is it to have a crisis of this magnitude with this pandemic to be politicized? And have we ever seen anything like it?
So from my perspective, the purpose of government at any level is to help individuals coordinate into collective action. So in a pandemic, a disease pandemic is a particularly good example of this because it addresses public health. The only way to get individuals to engage in collective action to protect their public health, like everybody wear a face mask, everybody wear a seatbelt, everybody stop at red lights, like whatever it is, the only way to get everybody to do the same thing is to have some rules in place and guidelines that either have punishments for violating the rules or incentives for following the rules or whatever it is. And the federal government is just failing to do that. But it's failing in a really specific way because the agencies in charge of pandemic response, particularly the CDC and Dr. Fauci's group and so forth, are putting out high quality information with guidelines and so forth and are at the cutting edge of figuring out the best policy implications for what we know about the virus given the science at any given time. But what's happening then is the White House is essentially undercutting that through political messaging. So you get this contradiction between what the CDC and Dr. Fauci's group puts out versus what Trump tweets or answers off the cuff in a news conference or the messaging that comes from a press briefing or whatnot. And the contradiction between those two means that the federal government itself cannot be an effective coordinator. So what we've seen instead is that it's all down to states. You actually can't understand the coronavirus pandemic in the United States at the national national level because there's too much variation across states and because the national government isn't really affecting the pandemic. It's states that are deciding what phase of opening to be at and what the mask requirements are going to be and how schools are going to operate and all of that kind of stuff.
But at the same time, you hear the president coming out with some very strong threats about schools and funding and things like that. So it's sort of trying to tell the states, this is on you, but yet I'm going to dictate how you do it. Politics, again, several times blamed Democrats for not wanting to open schools because it would make him look bad.
The president has a particularly sort of authoritarian style of politics. He likes to look in charge. He likes to put down people who disagree with him. And he likes to turn everything into a partisan issue because he thinks it helps to coalesce his political allies by showing that the other guys are against us, by turning everything into good guys and bad guys. It's been his political strategy since he entered politics. The problem is that it's a particularly bad way to govern a pandemic. The Trump brand of politics is very anti-science. It's very skeptical of government intervention in any type of policy making, and it's very partisan and divisive. And those are the three things that are exactly what you don't want in a pandemic. The research tells us that when people are afraid, when they are anxious, when they feel threatened by a security threat or a disease or whatever's going on that's a crisis, that's a threat to their life, what they feel comforted by is experts. So if it's a pandemic, they want to hear from the doctors. They want to hear from the scientists, the experts who understand what's literally happening. Anthony Fauci isn't just the government's top epidemiologist. He's also a particularly skilled science communicator. This is part of why he's good at what he does. And it's not that he tries to contradict the president or downplay what he says. It's that he's trying to prioritize getting the information out to the public in the political environment that he understands that we are in. And that's, in fact, why we see the public has much greater confidence in doctors and hospitals and Dr. Fauci and CDC than it does in Congress or Joe Biden or Donald Trump.
You know, before we started having this conversation, I was trying to narrow down what we should talk about. There are so many things that change on a daily basis. This crisis, that drama. Trump said this, Trump tweeted that. It's just been an ongoing sort of chase to get to the next event and understand what's going on before something else has happened. I'm sure that adds to a lot of people's confusion.
Absolutely. And my perspective, I think the White House uses crisis in a strategic political manner. When you have a crisis every day, when there's a new scandal and a new thing that happened, and oh, he pardoned this person, and isn't that a scandal? And oh, he said this, and isn't that a scandal? When there's just scandal and crisis on top of scandal and crisis, it becomes impossible for any single scandal or crisis to take over the media narrative because they're just bombarded with really important things all the time. So nothing becomes really important. So in a way, the fact that the narrative keeps changing and there's always some new emergency to paying attention to is a strategic choice on behalf of the White House to get people to not pay too much attention to the things that they think are going to be politically unpopular. I think we are starting to see a fair number of Republicans being a little bit worried about their political fates being married to this president. His approval numbers are dropping. He is getting himself into more and more hot water as the pandemic is mishandled. Rightly or wrongly, presidents are always blamed for economic issues. The economy is not doing well. And if the president goes down in flames, Republicans writ large don't want to go with him. And so if that coalition really starts to get more fractures in it, then it will become even more chaotic on the Republican side. Historically, what happens is you have political chaos in a political party with all sorts of fractures and disagreements and bloodshed, if you were, until there's massive electoral losses. And if you lose big, then it's much easier to come together and to figure out how to repair and rebuild the phoenix from the ashes. But unless and until that happens, I expect we'll be in for quite a bit more of political chaos.
Jennifer Victor, Associate Professor of Political Science at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thanks so much for being with us.
South Africa now accounts for about 40% of all coronavirus cases on the African continent, and the virus is spreading rapidly. On Sunday, a visibly angry President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed his people, begging them to adhere to guidelines limiting social gatherings and viral protections, and critically banning all alcohol sales and imposing a national curfew. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Coronavirus is spreading rapidly in South Africa, a move that has prompted officials to announce a host of new measures and restrictions. Nearly 4 months ago, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa announced a state of disaster and placed South Africa into one of the world's most restrictive lockdowns, with total bans on alcohol and tobacco and strict measures against movement and travel. Now, 18 weeks after the virus hit South African shores, the normally calm president addressed his nation with a stern countenance.
There are some amongst us who continue to ignore the regulations that have been passed to combat the disease. They also act without any responsibility to respect and protect others. In the midst of our national effort to fight against this virus, a number of people into organizing parties, who have drinking sprees, some who walk crowded spaces without the protection of masks.
And then after the lecture, the consequence.
The sale, the dispensing, and the distribution of alcohol will be suspended with immediate effect. There is now clear evidence that the resumption of alcohol sales has resulted in substantial pressure being put on hospitals, including trauma and ICU units. Most of these occur at night. Therefore, as an additional measure to reduce the pressure on hospitals, a curfew will be put in place between the hours of 9 p.m. and 4 a.m.
Health Department data support the dangers posed by alcohol consumption in South Africa, with Health Minister Zweli Mkhize linking the alcohol ban to a decrease in motor accidents and stabbings. Nevertheless, as Monday dawned, Ramaphosa was hit with swift political blowback. In a statement, opposition leader John Steenhuisen said the ban and curfew distract from the real issue, the utter failure to build treatment and testing capacity. Alcohol industry associations also weighed in, complaining they were given no warning about the sudden prohibition and warning that the industry's 1 million workers could suffer. For Johannesburg wine shop owner Jonah Naidu, Monday morning was a rude awakening. His small boutique wine shop already suffered a major hit during the first 2 months of lockdown, when they were completely shuttered. His shop will faithfully follow the new law, he says, but the prohibition raises some serious questions about how and whether he can stay afloat.
It was a wake up to a hard cold reality of how do we kickstart again? What do we say to the staff? How do we use the staff over this time? How do we keep them busy? Those are the big questions on our mind.
And he argues the ability to purchase alcohol deters from buying illicit alcohol. Anecdotal research shows that illicit sales boomed during the two-month lockdown, and hospital administrators noted a rise in hospitalizations and deaths from home-brewed alcohol. With nearly 280,000 cases and more than 10,000 new cases a day, everyone agrees these are tough times in the Rainbow Nation. That's something Ramaphosa acknowledged at the end of his sobering speech. "We will weather this storm," he said. "We shall overcome." Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In France, as a choir sang the French national anthem, members of the government rose to their feet on Tuesday and gave a long, drawn-out standing ovation to healthcare workers. It was all part of France's annual Bastille Day parade, which was dramatically toned down this year in what became a very emotional event led by French President Emmanuel Macron. Joining us now for details is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, a really emotional day.
This is the first time since 1945 that French authorities have called off the annual military parade. Usually it's some 3,000 to 4,000 troops, some of them on horseback, that parade down the Champs-Élysées. But not this year because of COVID and because they wanted to make it a very special National Day commemoration this year, because it was aimed at saying thank you to health workers and all those care workers who really stepped up to the plate during the height of the pandemic, during the lockdown. There were several moments when members of the invited group, I mean, there were only 2,500 guests, I mean, some of them were in tears when the national anthem was played at various stages. Certainly towards the end of the ceremony, when some members of the medical side of the military were taken to the front of the stage and walked up to the president, you could see some of them were in tears too, because this is a pandemic that's touched everybody. Every single person in France knows someone who's either working or who is sick or is sick themselves. So suddenly to have that very small moment on a very important day in French history, to be able to stand there and to have the president and the whole government standing there clapping you, thanking you for what you did to help the country through. It was very emotional. And there were a few of the old style parts of the Bastille Day parade, and that was the traditional flypast. There's the military coming by in their planes, and that also included one of the big transport planes that was used to evacuate some of the COVID patients from overwhelmed hospitals. And of course, there were representatives of Germany, Switzerland, Austria, and Luxembourg, who were some of the countries who took into their hospitals French patients in critical conditions when hospitals just couldn't cope anymore. So it was really a day of saying, thank you. This is a community effort. We're all working together, and together we will get through this period.
And after the event, the French President Emmanuel Macron did a big interview and talked a lot about going forward beyond this pandemic. What are some of the highlights?
The major highlight really was that he warned France that there is a rekindling of the epidemic in the country and that new measures could be brought in. They would be selective, but not as radical as a lockdown. He said that he would like to see some sort of mask being compulsory to be worn if you go into an enclosed space. And there were other areas which is very much his thing, which is climate change. He said that he feels that France is coming into a new era and that he would like to see a commitment to fighting climate change and for more biodiversity to be included in the French constitution. So as well as looking at where France has been, also looking at the way ahead. And that means more action on green, on climate policy, but also more action, he said, on the economy, because he warned at least a million more people will become unemployed within the next year.
And he also talked about any future vaccine would be completely equitable.
He did. There was, Sanofi was under some criticism here in France by at one stage saying that it would give the vaccine, if there was one, to the Americans first. Well, he made it pretty clear that there will be vaccines for France. But he also said there was an obligation for France to make sure that that vaccine is available worldwide. And it wouldn't just be for French citizens.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thanks so much. The United States said Monday that China's claims to offshore resources across most of the South China Sea are completely unlawful, as is Beijing's campaign of bullying to control them. The Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration, in a binding decision issued July 12, 2016, rejected China's maritime claims as having no basis in international law. China dismissed the ruling. Grant Newsham, a senior research fellow with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, spoke to International Edition's Steve Miller via Skype about the timing of Washington's statement.
Why the Trump administration has finally sort of said enough is an interesting question. And my guess is that it has something to do with events in probably say the last 4 or 5 months, where Chinese aggression and pushing has really gotten to the point all along its borders. From Japan to the Philippines, down to Malaysia, Indonesia, over to India, that I think it has reached a point where the administration said, you know, I would say we have nothing to lose, but the time is now. China may have rolled the dice and see how much they can get and maybe ready. And who knows, maybe there's something haven't heard, but that, you know, they are perhaps willing to take their shot. Say against Taiwan, maybe one of the offshore islands or in the East China Sea, the Senkakus with Japan. But I think it was Chinese behavior that has provoked this. And somehow the cumulative effect of what they've been doing, but I think the specifics of what they have, what has happened since the virus outbreak, I think that is alarming enough to cause the administration to do something no other administration has done and basically say we side with everybody else and not with China.
Is it too little too late? Because when you look at the events that have taken place in the South China Sea with Beijing's reclamation projects on different shoals to build bases essentially out of nothing, they're entrenched there. So what does a statement like this have in terms of quantifiable potential?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. And that is the key question. I think it's what everybody wants to know, particularly the other countries in the region, because, as you note, it's late in the day, and that China has been allowed to really insinuate itself and into the South China Sea physically and has a pretty strong military presence and the ability to almost exercise de facto military control as things stand. So what you have is the Americans have now said enough. You know, we're not going to allow this. We're not going to accept this behavior. And now the question is, you can imagine the Chinese saying, well, you know, I'm sure they're apoplectic as it is, but you can almost hear them saying, like some guy from Brooklyn, well, what are you going to do about it? And that's the question, is what are the Americans going to do and what can they do? They are going to have to, you know, beef up their military. Because currently the U.S. Navy just doesn't have enough ships. The Air Force needs more aircraft. But so they are going to have to do that. You know, this isn't going to be done on the cheap.
I wanted to ask you about ASEAN. You know, ASEAN has been trying to hammer out a definitive code of conduct with China for the South China Sea for a number of years. Where do you see things going with that body as a whole, with the claimants interacting with China?
The ASEAN nations know that they're being trifled with by the Chinese. You know, this code of conduct has been, it's been almost 20 years in the making now. And some of the Chinese demands have been absolutely outrageous. But ASEAN, I think, as I noted, they want an option. If you can give, you know, if there's somebody that they can turn to or align with that can help fend off Chinese pressure and domination, I think they'll be receptive to that, but they're going to, as they always are, I think they are going to be careful and quiet about how they do it. But, you know, I think that is where you can make some, the Americans can make some advances, but also, say, bolster their own position, because the more friends you have, even if they're quietly cooperating, the better.
Grant Newsham, senior research fellow with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller via Skype. As tensions between Libya's two rival governments and their international backers continue to worsen, the Eastern Libya-based parliament has authorized Egypt to intervene militarily if the security of either country is threatened. As Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo, despite the green light to Cairo, Parliament Speaker Akwaila Salah says he has asked the UN to continue mediation efforts to seek an agreement acceptable to all sides in the conflict.
Arab media broadcast video of Syrian militia fighters training near the Libyan capital Tripoli amid claims that Turkey has sent more mercenaries to Libya to support the UN-backed government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj. Libya's eastern-based parliament issued a statement late Monday authorizing Egypt, which supports the rival government of Abdullah al-Thani in Baida, to intervene militarily if necessary due to what it called Turkey's blatant intervention in Libya and breaching of the country's sovereignty. Libyan parliament spokesman Abdullah Blaihak, on a visit to Cairo Monday, thanked Egypt for helping his country. He says he thanked the Egyptian parliament for its support for Libya's security and stability in all areas, given that the security of both countries are intertwined and that the ties between them are long-standing. Despite the Eastern Libyan Parliament's authorization of a potential Egyptian military intervention in Libya, in the event either country's security is threatened, Parliament Speaker Akila Saleh told Arab media that he has asked the UN to continue mediating in the Libya conflict. He says that during his recent visit several days ago to the UN in Geneva, he asked Deputy UN Envoy Stephanie Williams to continue efforts to find a solution to the Libyan conflict that suits each side and coincides with previous talks in Cairo and Berlin. Egyptian General Mahmoud Zahar told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV he thinks Turkey is playing a game of nerves with Libya and Egypt, and that ultimately Ankara's goal is to cause the division of the country.
Libyan analyst Aya Borwaila, a visiting lecturer on security and terrorism at the Hellenic National Defense College in Greece, told VOA she thinks the Libyan parliament's authorization for Egypt to intervene should make it nearly impossible for Turkey and its Syrian proxies to capture Libya's strategic oil crescent. She called the conflict an existential crisis for both Egypt and Libya, since neither can allow Libya to become a failed state, exploited by what she calls Turkish political and military proxies, which include militant jihadists and organized crime networks. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, told VOA, however, that he worries the Libyan parliament's declaration could lead to a conflict because mistakes are made when things are this heated. He also questions if Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan might not take the warning as a challenge. Turkey, inspired largely by its energy interests in Libya, has been boosting its role in the Libyan conflict, saying it is doing so in support of the internationally recognized government in Tripoli. Its expanding role is also raising concerns of what analysts say could be the start of a proxy war. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The Trump administration has rescinded a rule that would have required international students to transfer schools or leave the country if their colleges hold classes entirely online this fall. The decision was announced at the start of a hearing in a federal lawsuit in Boston brought by Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The announcement brings relief to thousands of foreign students who've been at risk of being deported, along with hundreds of universities scrambling to reassess their plans for fall. The European Commission plans to seek input from the public and civic bodies on how to combat fake news and ensure free and fair elections, a move that could lead to new rules targeting social platforms such as Facebook and Google. Social media has come under fire on both sides of the Atlantic for carrying political ads that contain false or misleading claims ahead of elections, with the upcoming U.S. presidential election on November 3rd a key focus. VOA's International Edition continues. For the first time since March, The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon originated from its regular studio in New York. AP Entertainment correspondent Margie Zaraletta reports.
Monday's Tonight Show featured Jimmy Fallon and the house band The Roots appearing on opposite ends of the stage in front of an empty audience. Sometimes they laughed uncomfortably because there was no one there to laugh. Fallon says he's trying to keep everyone safe.
When I got in this morning, I had a temperature check. I did the nose swab test, the one that goes all the way up into your brain. I didn't know that at the same time you can get a COVID test and a colonoscopy.
The guests were Charlize Theron, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, and Little Big Town appearing remotely. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
A little-known member of one of rock and roll music's royal families, Benjamin Keough, grandson of the late Elvis Presley and only son of the king's daughter, Lisa Marie Presley, has died at the age of 27. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bungani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
When you don't believe a word I say, say hello.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging elections?